So, colleagues, I think what the panelists have done for us has given us a really good overview, not only of the enormous complexity of the challenges we face in moving from or in dealing with risk societies to ensuring resilient societies. They've also outlined for us why science is important. Specifically, Stefan and Virginia have outlined what are the roles and the tasks of science that we now face. Ava has given us examples of what scientists are doing, some of the contributions that are being made, particularly from young scientists. We've seen in Virginia's presentation the growing opportunities for science to become engaged in the policy implications of this. The yellow highlights are impressive, Virginia. And I think this, you know, this really is not just about the role of science, but the opportunities we now confront. Gordon has sketched for us, in terms of the international landscape, some of the existing programs and networks that are available that we can use to mobilize. And finally, I think what Ava's also done is thrown in a nice example of not only the role of science, but the role of scientists. And that's different. So it's not just about knowledge production, but she raises questions, and I think in some of her examples, of what else is it that scientists can and do and how they become involved. So what I want us to do is to thank our panelists for sticking to the time, because it means we have time for discussion and debate. So please join me in thanking the panelists again. We will come back to you, Professor Jucha, but we first take some questions. We have a good, we have a good half hour for discussion with the panelists. I would encourage the panelists to ask questions of each other as well, so do signal if you have questions, but I'm going to throw this open to the floor now. So. Ah, interesting. Resilient audience. What about the panelists? Do you have questions of each other? Cool. Sorry? Oh, good. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One of the panelists, I think it was Virginia, mentioned the importance of data. I wondered what was the panel's view of the most important data sets we need that we currently lack.
Who wants to take that for dinner?
Wow, that's a nice present. Thank you. First of all, do you know this document, A World That Counts? I think it's been a fantastic resource that's come again from the United Nations on trying to pull together data and how we use it. But to me, the whole in everything that we do in disaster risk reduction is how do we count disasters? It is really worrying that it's very hard to do. There are certain databases around the world. There's the one from Belgium that contributes a lot. There's the Disinventar one. And there's a really exciting new development at Tohoku University in Japan to try and improve the statistics. But the call is at the moment to try and agree what the definitions and terminology are, and then to add clear indicators that support these seven global targets that I mentioned briefly. And I think that if we can start understanding what we mean by disaster, I know that you gave the classic definition, Gordon, but in our Sendai framework, we are looking at all hazards, every type of hazard, be they natural or man-made, be they pandemic or epidemic, and Sierra Leone were really clear that we better get that in the framework. So these member states are calling for this. It is absolutely crucial that we do not only the Big Bang intensive events, the ones that we all see in the media, but the ones that I really care about are the extensive little events, which are so much harder to recover from. There's so much to sustain development with. It is much harder to deal with these because you often don't get the resources that you need to be able to consider a process of recovery and the building back better. But often they happen in cascading effects. So you get a concatenation of events, which makes those who are most vulnerable just go from one crisis to the next, and they become more and more vulnerable, as Gordon's slide showed, that those people who really find it difficult to recover will find it even harder with a series of events. So I think actually counting is going to be one of the most interesting things on disaster data. So that's the one, that would be my choice of any database that we have. The other choice I would have is, can we agree what we mean by mortality and death from disaster? Now, if we look at, were to look at floods, is it drowning? That's probably quite obvious if we get flooded. But is it actually electrocution? Because in Thailand, most of the deaths that related to their terrible floods in 2010 were due to electrocution. And then there's increasing concern about vector-borne diseases with climate change and the risk of those. And how do we count those? Are they part of the flooding picture? Because only with the extra stagnant flood water would we have had increased numbers of vectors. And finally, the bit that really has worried us in the United Kingdom is actually the fact that a lot of people who are dealing with recovery from floods, often in a very private and personal way, end up by really getting distressed by the problems they have with their insurance companies, their builders, and they are at higher risk of suicide. Now, is that something we should count as mortality? So we're struggling with this terminology, which I glossed over, about how we define these things. So there's a huge amount of science that we need to use to try and make sure we get this data right. So anybody who's interested, we're looking for help.
Thanks, Virginia. Gordon, you have a comment, and then Stefan, I'll come to you.
Yes, I was going to comment that in a way it follows both from what Virginia just said, but what Stefan said earlier. When we get into data, one of the issues that I was going to talk about, then I eliminated from it, is, for example, the freezing rain events that Stefan referred to. We had a huge event like that in eastern Canada, centered around Montreal in 1998. The city of Montreal was largely shut down for a month or more. And as the head of the weather service, I thought, well, we got out of it okay. 10 years later, I was invited to speak at a conference at the medical school in Montreal. And there I was appalled as a parent and grandparent to have them, all these medical specialists, talk about that the children who weren't even born then, in their mother's womb, were mentally and physically, statistically, handicapped, mentally and physically, 10 years later. And when we start talking, as Virginia was saying, what is mortality? What is the, how do you count the statistics? The societal impacts of these things in a long-term way can really be horrific, and we don't yet know how to, and how do you, when you draw the line of the impact of that disaster, that freezing rain event, and as Stephen referred to, is the, although with global warming we will have no freezing rain events in Canada, at least according to the numbers I've been using in presentations there, nothing in, say, March, nothing in November, the actual projections is that we'll have a 50% increase in the number of heavy freezing rain events in January. And those are the ones that cause the power lines to go down and the damage. And as far as I can see, there is not yet any reaction to that from the electric power facilities to make their resilience embedded into the system to deal with that kind of thing. And anyway, the other thing I was going to say is that during that Sendai meeting, going back to there was a very strong push, and I was pleased with it, from the financial sector, particularly the insurance companies. The CEO of Willis Re gave a presentation on a panel that I happened to be a member of, but I was he had the real impact. And what he said was, we have to get everyone in society to start looking at the 1 in 100 year risk. Not the event that will happen 100 years from now, but could happen next year. But the risk is 1 in 100 years or even 1 in 200. And force governments, private sector, communities, etc., to actually publicly and analyze and put this information up for to be seen by society in a broad sense of that word. And I think that's one of the things that not only is good from a point of view of a strategy of action, but is also, let's say, quite frankly, challenge us as a scientist, is how do you define a 1 in 100 year risk when you start looking, as we need to, into these very broad sectors of issues, resilience, mental health, etc. Thank you.
Thanks, Gordon. Stefan?
Just quickly to come in on this, I just wanted to make a point about not believing too much in data as the silver bullet to solve problems that we can not understand very well. We all know that we're living in a very rapidly developing world, and of course terminology and alignment and data are very, very important where they serve. It can be also a little bit detrimental if we try to work out everything on data where the general trends are all right and are well acknowledged by everyone. So in risk management, what you often do is do scenario modeling to avoid coming to a complex thing where all of a sudden you need to know all different data pieces, bring them together in a harmonized way, and that will take you longer than the risk factor will stay stable. So things that Gordon has mentioned, risk or once in 100 years might be once in 10 years before we have the data together for once in 100 years. The world is just developing on, so and this is just a complement, it's not a substitute. As a complement to the idea of just getting the databases aligned, we also need to consider where we have general consensus, we rather need to hurry up and get going. And these are things that we would not have to wait a data consolidation for, but really do the obvious thing to just cut down the risk.
Okay. So, more questions. I see some. Yep, Tracy?
Thank you. This is a question really for all of the panelists, but I think particularly to Gordon and to Virginia. One of the things I'm trying to reconcile is we've heard about how scientists organise themselves around some of these agendas. So we've heard about the research infrastructure through all of the types of structures that Gordon has talked about. And we've then heard Virginia saying that there is, so that's the supply side. We've heard Virginia talking about the demand side created from the Sendai framework, and that there's a science and technology advisory group associated to UNISDR. So there's quite a lot of infrastructure there. There seems to be, from what you're saying, that there is some kind of systems failure, or failure somewhere along the line, that the right information, whether it's scale, whether it's the structure isn't fit for purpose, the design is incorrect. What is it that is not working in the structure, which seems to be quite well defined, but somehow isn't working properly? Is it scale? Is it inclusion? Is it design? I think those are sort of the whole range of questions there, but I'm trying to reconcile that difference between supply and demand.
Okay, thank you. Before I come to you, Ava, did you want to come in on the previous issue? Sorry that I skipped you.
No, no problem. It was just a really brief comment that I agree that we need to keep the speed of things and developing in mind, but at the same time, in my view, the issue of open data and promoting open data and getting our act together on open data and coordinating that effort really well is crucial for the long term.
Okay, thanks for that. Gordon, and then Virginia, will you respond?
Okay. Respond very quickly. Just since Eva mentioned the open data question, I think I said this in one of my innumerous speeches already at this meeting, but for those who didn't hear it, we will have in December the Science International meeting, will be held actually in South Africa, but it's a global meeting of the four major non-governmental science organizations, Council for Science, Social Science Council, Inter-Academy Partnership, and TWAS, to agree on a open data statement of policy, of logic, of things, principles. And so we are trying to address this. It won't be the final word. It will be an attempt, though, to initiate a sustained discussion. But back to the question that was asked about, well, it was sort of research infrastructure, but also, well, we've got this research. And in my earlier talk today, I talked about focusing events and agenda setting. It is very clear, unfortunately, that often we get these kind of big responses. I mean, quite frankly, the meeting in that came to the Hyogo Framework for Action in 2005 would have been largely a null event. No one was going until, unfortunately, the Indian Ocean tsunami tragedy. So governments respond. And then they do things and then respond later. We have to somehow, with our science community, influence, and I think we have to do this by being generally speaking out to our communities in general, to be advocates for taking a longer-term, less, tragic event focus. I'm a former government bureaucrat in Canada, and I often was more than once asked by my minister saying, well, what's going to happen between now and the next election? And if it isn't going to happen that I can guarantee it, then why don't we deal with something else? It's unfortunate, and we need to somehow or other, as a multidimensional science community, work together to build that research capacity and the response to the capacity of implementing strategies, responses, so that we do have that implementation of those resilient measures that need to be taken, because there's a tendency to put off things like that. The idea of 1 in 100 year risk sounds really good when we talk about it, but I don't get much response when I talk to private sector companies that are again worrying about their bottom line for the next 6 months. So, sorry, I'm not being too cynical, but anyway, I think it's part of our responsibility to help push that idea, and that means getting out to the communities in a broad-based. Thank you.
Thanks, Gordon. Virginia?
Thank you, Haida. Tracy, a question that I'm really pleased to hear, because I can't reiterate enough that it's the member states who are demanding science, not scientists offering to supply it. And I think this is a really different thing to what we're trying to do. The other thing that we feel is really important is there is a huge amount of science there already, but it's not explicitly available. And people find it hard to find. And I think that's one of the real concerns that we have. So at our conference, we hope very much that we will have this opportunity to try and pull what is already known together and identify where the gaps are, and have a process for dealing with this. And as the Joint Research Centre is part of this programme, may I announce it, that you're setting up a knowledge hub? Do you mind? So the Joint Research Centre is setting up a knowledge hub. Thank you. Now, there are several knowledge hubs that are coming together, but I really wanted to say a huge thank you to the Joint Research Centre to try and help us find that science that's available and make it accessible, available, useful, usable, and used. But to me, there is one gap that you asked for. Why is it not working? Well, I think one of the things that's come through in our discussions, and again, I thank Japan hugely for a lot of this focus, is that there is not a system inside individual countries for using their own science that is very clearly and explicitly there. So under the UNISDR system, there's a call for national platforms. There are currently, when I last counted, 116 national platforms, but a lot of them don't include scientists, which means people are making decisions without having usefully engaged with scientists to try and make sure that the decisions they're making are something that can be useful, usable, and used. I'll keep saying it, I'm sorry. But it does get the message across. So the idea of having focal points within countries that I think are really important. So I think Peter Gluckman has just come in. Peter, you are there. Peter, can I pass this over to you? Because you made some really strong points at the International Network for Science Advice to Government when we had our meeting earlier. And I just wonder if you wanted to reiterate that, if that's acceptable, Haida.
Absolutely, Peter. And then I'll come to the gentleman.
Yes, I think a common thing that's come through in the digestion of governmental responses to a number of recent crises, and I will use the case of the Christchurch earthquake in New Zealand, but I know that the same thing's true in a number of other events, but I feel safer talking about faults in our own country. That is, this was an earthquake. The government's rapidly got seismological inputs, they got reasonably rapidly trauma recovery inputs, obviously. They forgot about psychological recovery, the point that I think Virginia made, till about 3 weeks after the episode. They did not think about a number of other technical aspects till about 2 weeks after the episode, by which there were compounding problems emerging. And that's led myself, in fact, was a subject of discussion by the APEC Chief Science Advisors and Equivalents meeting in Kuala Lumpur only 2 weeks ago, to say, having digested a number of other events in the Asia Pacific Rim, including the Fukushima earthquake, if you don't have a single point of integrated scientific input from minute one of the crisis, there is a danger of major gaps emerging, because governments will tend to go, if it's a flood, they'll go to a hydrological engineer. If it's an earthquake, they'll go to a seismologist. If it's an Ebola, they'll go to the public health community or the infectious disease. They forget that there's multidimensional aspects to this from day one. There always are. There's always psychological aspects, there's often trade aspects, other aspects come into play. And therefore, the APEC science advisors have strongly recommended, it will obviously depend on how the leaders' declaration goes in a few weeks, that there needs to be, during a crisis, a single point of integrated scientific coordination for seeking all the domains of advice that are needed, which is effectively the same thing of what you're saying, Virginia, using slightly different words.
Thank you very much, Peter. So we have a question here in front.
Thank you. I'm Zabi from Jordan, IAS, Islamic World Academy of Sciences. I think that science, this is picking on from the previous speaker, science has often failed to express an opinion at the right moment, either owing to the failure of science itself to predict certain environmental, political, water-related, energy-related problems, or the capacity of scientists and those in the domain of science and technology to convey the risks associated with certain phenomena to the decision makers. Now, I can cite many examples from the Middle East in terms of water resources and river basins. Jordan River Basin, shadow of its former glorious self now. And history tells us that environmentalists were really very hesitant to convey the risks associated with this to politicians back in the 60s and 70s. Same goes for the Tigris, Euphrates River Basin, the Nile River Basin now. The Aral Sea in Central Asia is another example. And more recently, at the political level, the inability of the science and technology community to convey concerns to politicians and decision makers in the Middle East on events that eventually became the Arab Spring or the Arab Pseudo-Spring. This despite the fact that within the UNESCO Science Report of 2010, which I happen to be one of the co-authors, it was mentioned that unless and until governance in the majority of Arab states is no longer in a state of turmoil and good governance becomes the norm, then many of the Arab countries would be witnessing upheaval. And that's what happened. So my basic question is this: how can we develop a best practice, if that's the right word, of conveying elements of risk, or trying to persuade politicians and policymakers, or draw their attention better to potential science-based or science-related risks, political risks, environmental risks, climate change risks. The modality is not there, I feel. Thank you.
I'm looking at the panel. Virginia, you want to come in on this?
I think you've asked a really good question. Now, Sir Peter Gluckman, as the government chief scientific advisor for New Zealand, obviously has been handling that, and that's why I asked Peter to step in, just to try and explain what happens. We also know that there's always a bit of conflict between scientists themselves. So they can be quite excited about how they share their information. I see a few nods in the room. So in the UK, we have a very, quite an exciting system that's evolved. We too have a government chief scientific advisor, and it is his office under the Government of Science that goes to our cabinet office meetings where there are real concerns, which the Prime Minister or other ministers chair. But he also has another tool called the Scientific Advisory Group in Emergencies. And he can bring them all together, and we can have the debate there, and then one opinion's agreed. And it is taken forward as the way forward, trying to give the widest range of how things work. Now, that's just a UK solution that we've worked towards. But your comment about scientists not being courageous enough, possibly, to work with either local communities or with politicians, was something that I found really clearly when I went on my rounds of the regions of the world, when we had the regional platforms on disaster risk reduction. And I'm not suggesting by any means that Latin America and South America and the Americas were struggling with this, but it was a comment that came through very strongly that a lot of their scientists had not been trained in a way that they could communicate with policymakers, be it the architects or be it the indigenous, those with indigenous knowledge. And I found that a really quite surprising message, because they had come together as a group where all the member states and their politicians and ministers were represented. So I wonder if there's some sort of training that we need to encourage. And that's why I was so interested in Annette's talk this morning about her sustainable development goal and how we might need to think about how we train people differently. So to me, this particular forum, the World Science Forum, has been a wonderful place to do a lot of that thinking. So I'm really enjoying it. Thank you, Haida.
Great. Stefan and then Eva.
Right. A couple of considerations. Of course, coming from the Joint Research Center of the European Commission, whose mandate it is to give scientific and policy and technological advice to the policymakers, I can really tell you that this is a formalized instrument that helps. And unless you formalize the relationships between science and policy making, probably it will be very difficult for standard scientists that are educated in doing research to really make themselves heard in the right way. Unless you have a chief science advisor to the government, unless you have a joint research center, unless you have a scientific and advisory mechanism or anything like that, it will be very difficult for a researcher to speak up on his own behalf without a clear mandate and then get the messages, the right messages, channeled into the right ears. The second thing then is, of course, how would policymakers respond or even hear risk messages? And this is something where, I mean, I've been working in industry for quite some years as chief security officer, and it is always a difficult question, because you cannot earn a lot of credits or merits by just pointing out hypothetical risk. And then somebody needs to invest to make nothing happen. The success of a risk manager or a security manager is to avoid something from happening. And this is, of course, something that you cannot easily tick off your agenda. Had you been the one who has ruined the aircraft industry for just asking steel doors to the cockpits, you might have been the one who would have also made impossible a 9/11 event happening, but nobody would have ever noticed. Had you been the one who had invented the steel doors, you would have been the one who would have been looked at critically, because there was a suicide pilot in German wings recently and the people were not able to get in the cockpit. So the point is really very difficult here, and there is no silver bullet solution. But the difficult idea about risk communication and following up on investment is, listen, can't we just keep it as is and nothing will happen anyway? And then we're back to that once in 100 years thing that could come about tomorrow or not with in the next election period.
Thanks, Stefan. Eva?
I wanted to comment in a very practical way, because I clearly see that need within young scientists to learn to work with policymakers and to learn to work with other stakeholders in the community. And with the Global Young Academy, we started to organize leadership programs. For example, the Africa Leadership Program has started this year, the Africa Science Leadership Program, I should say. And that is a very intensive training program for young fellows, early to mid-career researchers, who get together for a week and actively train on these type of skills during a week and come up with a practice project that they want to apply, so where they want to, for example, engage with policymakers on a very specific topic. And then during the year, they are supported by the program to conduct their project, and they come back. And our goal then is to get more stakeholders even in the room and get these fellows to present, to start developing these relationships, because often it comes down to personal relationships as well to make it effective. And that's where we try to grow it now. And this is the first year we've done it. We're starting now one in ASEAN as well. And there are other initiatives that are also very promising. I mean, the EU has this wonderful Members of European Parliament researcher pairing scheme. The AAAS has these fellowships, policy fellowships, that I hear people have tremendous benefit from. And in a way, I see huge opportunities actually also at universities to do longer term exchanges or internships for both policymakers to be and scientists to be, to really learn from each other's worlds and develop those relationships that later on, 5-10 years down the track, will be very